Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
How should we remember Cleopatra? A pretty young temptress rolling out of a carpet? A mighty queen sailing majestically down the Nile? An imperious pharaoh with the power of life and death? Or simply a girl born into a dangerous world who managed to survive for almost four decades until her luck finally ran out? There's an element of truth in all of them. More than 2,000 years after she was born, she remains the most famous woman in history, a fighter, a survivor, a leader, a legend. For centuries to come, people will remember her story. And that, you might say, was her greatest victory. That is the ending of a top new book on Cleopatra, Queen of the Nile, by a very distinguished historian, Dominic Sambrook. Dominic, this is the latest in your series of books written for younger readers.
It is indeed. Yes, the latest adventure in time. So Cleopatra was an obvious one to pick for kind of 8 to 12-year-olds, because they, like the rest of us, are suckers for, I mean, suckers is the wrong word. They, like the rest of us, are enthusiasts for glamour, intrigue, battles.
Gold.
Sieges, gold.
Yeah.
Glitter.
Sphinxes. All that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Doom love affairs. All the things that we associate with ancient Egypt, with ancient Rome, and particularly with the character of Cleopatra.
So people who've listened to this podcast on a regular basis may remember that we also did an episode on Alexander the Great. And Dominic, yeah. The reason that we did an episode on Alexander the Great is because your previous book in this series was on Alexander.
Yeah.
And in the end of that book, you offered up Alexander the Great as a model for young children everywhere. And we've got a question here from Judith Downey, who says, I bought Dominic's book on Cleopatra for my granddaughters. Before I give it to them, can you tell me, is Cleopatra a role model for girls?
I think she absolutely is a role model for girls, Tom. I don't think role models for girls need to be drippy. And I think Cleopatra is the most famous example in history of a powerful woman. So there aren't that many historical examples of very, very powerful, internationally famous women. I suppose Catherine the Great is an obvious one. Elizabeth I in England. But Cleopatra dwarfs both of those.
I completely agree.
She is the last ruling pharaoh of Egypt. She is a prime actor in one of the greatest political dramas in all history, the last days of the Roman Republic, the rise of Rome to greatness, the death of Egypt as a sort of independent civilization. But also she's a remarkable woman because she's in a world dominated by men and she holds her own. She actually increases her dominions, doesn't she?
Yes, and that's the thing. She doesn't just hold her own. I mean, there is a point at which it looks as though not only is she going to restore the empire that her forefathers ruled, but she's going to create something even greater. I mean, she is, I think, an absolutely extraordinary figure. And part of the fascination, of course, is that she's not only an extraordinary political figure, but she also has this aura of romance and glamour and myth about her, which is a huge part of her kind of public image today, but was generated by herself and by her enemies. And it's the kind of fusion of those two traditions that makes the whole story so fascinating.
Well, that's what, so most of our listeners, if you don't know the story of Cleopatra terribly well, you will probably at least vaguely know that she's involved with Julius Caesar, she's involved with Mark Antony, and she has this sort of tragic death. And you'll know all that from innumerable plays, operas, musicals, video games. You know, she crops up everywhere from the Elizabeth Taylor film to kind of Assassin's Creed, the video game.
Asterix, Carry On film.
Carry On films, exactly. I mean, there's no other historical, I don't think there's any other female historical character who has been represented in so many different media and who also carries that sort of whiff of danger, of sexual danger as Cleopatra. And as we'll discover, Tom, Whether that's merited or
yes. not is kind of very interesting. Because this is a kind of classic example of the way in which the myth, the legend itself, is dazzling and remarkable and has generated, you know, great, great poetry. So there's the famous lines in Antony and Cleopatra by Shakespeare, where he portrays this story. And he has Cleopatra kind of stressing about what will happen after she and Antony have died. And she says, "Antony shall be brought drunken forth, and I shall see some squeaking Cleopatra boy my greatness in the posture of a whore." So she's imagining that, you know, a boy will appear on the stage and pretend to be her. Yeah. And in a way, that's, you know, that's part of the extraordinary power of this, is that Cleopatra as a historical figure was playing a role, as we will discuss. And it's precisely that kind of self-dramatization that has made her such a potent figure for Shakespeare, for Elizabeth Taylor, for everyone who's, you know, yeah, such an extraordinary kind of interplay and interaction.
But Tom, I know you're incredibly keen to talk about the sort of, to do a lot of debunking and to talk about the sort of sources and stuff. So before we really kick off the narrative, which we intend to go through, you know, in real detail, as we have done in the past with Alexander and with the Falklands and things like that, it's worth saying, isn't it? I mean, you alluded to the fact that she self-mythologizes, but also there's a mythology created by her enemies. And mm-hmm. The extraordinary thing about Cleopatra, of all these characters in history, you know, she's one of the top four or five most famous characters in all history. But almost every single thing we know about her comes from her enemies. That's right, isn't it? I mean, there are a handful of inscriptions. There are temple carvings, but the written descriptions come from Roman sources that are actually describing her effect on the Romans. That's right, isn't it? There's nothing written down by Egyptians. There's no narrative by Egyptians.
No. I think there is Josephus, who is a Jewish writer writing about 100 years after she lived, but then the Jews are very hostile to her as well. But having said that, I mean, it is absolutely possible to see the kind of the mythology that she was spinning. So I think you do. And I think that part of the fascination of her character is precisely that actually those two traditions kind of meld and merge in a very kind of effective way, kind of gin and tonic effect.
Right,
that they're more fascinating for complementing each other, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, no, I do. I absolutely see that.
I think we should start by putting her in the context of the age that she's born. Yeah. And we mentioned Alexander the Great. So you begin your book with Cleopatra as a young girl in the tomb of Alexander, right? Because you've said that she's an Egyptian pharaoh, but the complicating factor is that she's not herself kind of an Egyptian. She's not bred of the mud of the Nile. She's not, you know,
exactly,
not like the native pharaohs. She is the descendant of one of Alexander the Great's generals.
Yeah, that's right. So there's always an element of, in any biography of Cleopatra, there's always an element of fiction or speculation because we know so little about her early life. And when I was kicking off my own kids' book, I thought, you know, there's the challenge of doing these massive kind of info dumps. And one way of doing, of dramatizing it, is imagining something that she would undoubtedly have done. We know that the Ptolemies did this. They had festivals around Alexander's tomb because Alexander's tomb was in Alexandria. So it's not a flight of fantasy to imagine her there. So why does that matter? Because in the 4th century, as we discussed it, the 4th century BC, as we discussed in our Alexander podcasts, Alexander had led these armies out of Macedonia and conquered so much of what used to be called the Near East, including Egypt. And at his death, the empire had been divided up among his kind of captains. And the shrewdest and basically the cleverest of them, Ptolemy, his old friend who'd been educated at the feet of Aristotle alongside Alexander, he goes off to Egypt. He says he wants Egypt because it's the richest, but it's the easiest to defend because it's kind of at the end of the line, if you know what I mean. So yeah, it's easy to, you know, it's wealthy. You've got the wealth of the Nile, but you can ease, as long as you, if you can hold the line at the Delta, you can stop anybody breaking in. And Ptolemy goes, he rules as pharaoh. So as Alexander had done, he sort of assimilates to Egyptian traditions, doesn't he?
And he takes a key.
Yes.
A key legitimizing item, which is the coffin of Alexander the Great, doesn't he? I mean, he literally transports it from Babylon, where Alexander has died, and takes it all the way to Egypt.
That's
which
right.
Which is, you know, the imprimatur of his own. It's the Greek imprimatur of what will become his Egyptian pharaonic status.
So what happens, what's so interesting, right at the beginning, is you have this melding of Egyptian and Macedonian Greek traditions. So they wear the double crown, of Upper and Lower Egypt. They are depicted, these sort of Macedonian adventurers are depicted as Egyptian pharaohs, but they have a brand new capital built on the shores of the Mediterranean and the site supposedly chosen by Alexander himself, Alexandria. And at the very heart of Alexandria, as you say, is the tomb of Alexander. And the interesting thing is they depict themselves as Egyptians. They are very respectful to the priests, but it's really important to them that they are still Macedonian Greeks. And the sign of that is the fact that they only marry, they marry one another. So this is the really remarkable thing, isn't it? So Ptolemy dies in, I think, 282 or 284 or something. And his son, also Ptolemy, takes over. And he's called Ptolemy Philadelphus, which means the sibling lover. And he's called that because he marries his own sister, Arsinoe. And that then starts the trend, the thing that Ptolemy is most famous for. So it's like this sort of clan of warriors have established themselves, but they're sticking to their own, even though they're very careful at turning up at Egyptian temple ceremonies and all that sort of stuff, but they're still very, very Greek, aren't they?
But they could point out that Hera and Zeus, so the queen and the king of the Greek gods, married one another, and they're very good at finding Greek parallels for Egyptian elements. And so they even construct a god, Serapis, who is kind of combination of Heracles and Osiris and all these kind of various Greek and Egyptian gods. And they invent him and he becomes essentially the presiding deity of Alexandria. But I think it is important to emphasize that the predominant tone of the Greek inhabitants of Alexandria, and I think of the Ptolemies themselves, by and large, right the way up into Cleopatra. And this is why Cleopatra is such a key figure. Most of the Ptolemies are pretty contemptuous of Egypt and Egyptian culture. And they regard the wealth of Egypt as something to be leached. So the Egyptians themselves, I think, view Alexandria as a foreign city, like an enormous kind of great tick that has attached itself to the body of Egypt and is just leaching all the blood out of it. And
well, Tom, I mentioned Assassin's Creed as one of the depictions of Cleopatra. Now, I know you're not a video games person, but anybody who has played video games or has played that particular video game, Assassin's Creed Origins, will know that it creates this colossal and incredibly detailed portrait of Ptolemaic Egypt. And it's all very Egyptian pyramids and kind of huts and the Nile and all that sort of stuff. And in the game, which has been done with sort of intense cooperation with kind of historians and archaeologists, you get to Alexandria. And it's marble colonnades and it's people and the other characters are talking in Greek rather than in Egyptian. And it's sort of scholars strolling in gardens. Yeah. And it feels very, very Greek, as indeed Alexandria must. I mean, it was cosmopolitan, but it saw itself, didn't it, as part of the Greek world?
Well, I mean, it's literally Cosmopolis. It's the city of the universe, and its ambition. It's the ambition of Alexandria is to contain within its streets everything. So its great harbors to contain ships that have come from across the world, from not just from the Mediterranean, but from India and Africa. And of course, its famous library. Again, the ambition is to contain all the learning that there is. But this ambition is a Greek ambition, and the city is a Greek city, and the rulers are Greek. And the relationship with Egypt is always, therefore, incredibly paradoxical.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a proper kind of, it is a colonial relationship right the way up to the time of Cleopatra. And one of the things that makes Cleopatra so distinctive is that she moves beyond that.
So Cleopatra is born, we think, at the beginning of 69 BC or late 70 BC, probably January 69 BC. And she's born, isn't she, Tom, into a world in which that empire, the Ptolemaic Empire, is a shadow of its. Yeah. So what's happened, would you say, to... What's gone wrong?
So we talked about Alexander and as one bookend of a distinctive period that historians call the Hellenistic era, and Cleopatra is the other. And the Hellenistic period basically describes the successor empires, the successor states of Alexander. And to begin with, they're incredibly potent. And Ptolemaic Egypt is one of basically three successor states. However, what happens over the course of the second and first centuries BC is that a new superpower is rising in the West, and there has never been a superpower like it in the Mediterranean. And by the time that Cleopatra is born, essentially the whole of the Mediterranean has come under the the influence, the authority of this emergent superpower. And that superpower, of course, is Rome, which is a republic. And the republic is founded on a contempt for kings, which means that the very structure of government in Alexandria, the entire essence of monarchy, the Pharaonic traditions, the Macedonian traditions, are viewed by Roman republican leaders with the utmost contempt.
Yeah. And the Egyptians have started to lose territory, haven't they? So they had expanded beyond their borders. They'd held kind of Cyprus and Cyrene, which is now Libya, and parts of Syria. But that's all being whittled away by the Romans, isn't it? And the Alexandrian crowd, who are always... So Alexandria is both a city of philosophy and great learning, but it's also got this terrible tradition of rioting.
Well, it's officially a democracy. I mean, that's another kind of fascinating aspect of it, is that it's a monarchy, but it's also a democracy. And so the people of Alexandria...
They're always throwing out Ptolemies and replacing them with their brothers.
There's a tradition that the women of Alexandria in riots will go and grab people's testicles. Men's
testicles. That's nice.
Yeah, that's a distinctive feature of Alexandria.
I didn't put that in the children's book.
No,
I hope not. Cleopatra. So let's talk a tiny bit about Cleopatra's parents. So we know who her father was. He is Ptolemy the 12th, who's nicknamed Auletes, the flute player.
Some people always say
that's very... Well, there are two different schools of thought on this, as far as I can tell. One is that this is because he's dissipated and he spends all his time at parties, which seems like a very Roman way of orientalizing way of describing Ptolemy. And the other is that he's called this because he enjoyed the religion of Dionysus and that, you know, playing the flute or the clarinet and... sort of dancing and all that sort of stuff was part of the religious sort of tradition. What's your take on Cleopatra's father?
Well, he has a very bad hand. And he has a bad hand because over the course of his reign, the other great rival, traditional rival of Egypt, Ptolemaic Egypt, Syria, the Seleucid Empire, gets extinguished by Pompey the Great, who is Rome's greatest general. In the 60s and 50s BC. And he extinguishes Seleucid independence. He captures Jerusalem. He goes back to Rome, kind of trailing kings and wealth and glory. But he doesn't take over Egypt. Egypt is left, but it's absolutely under sufferance. And one of the reasons why Egypt is not taken over is that it's too rich. So not even the Pompey's rivals will not permit him to annex Egypt, but nor will anyone else be allowed to do it because it's simply too rich. And so that's a very humiliating position for Ptolemy Auletes to be in, because basically he's on the throne precisely because he is seen as so weak.
Yeah.
And the nickname, I think it has a kind of double resonance. It symbolizes for the Romans the fact that Ptolemaic Egypt is contemptible, decadent. It's all about... You know, they're not interested in manly things like conquering Gaul or stuff like that. They're just interested in parties. But also it's sinister because there are religious traditions. These are, you know, Egypt is a land where the gods have animal heads and all kinds of ancient, dark, sinister practices. None of it that is really conducive with the stern ancestral republican traditions of Rome.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a slight, you know, it's anachronistic. But the way in which, say, Republican Americans would look at the monarchies of Europe in the 19th century, something of that quality, I think, is there.
That makes complete sense. But then there's the issue of her mother. So his wife, Ptolemy's wife, was called Cleopatra Tryphena, is often thought to have been, we're not exactly sure, but she's probably some kind of relative, some part of the clan, but not his sister. But there is some doubt, or doubt is sometimes expressed about Cleopatra's own ethnicity. Because, for example, when Gal Gadot, the Israeli actress, said that she wanted to remake Elizabeth Taylor's Cleopatra and she wanted to play Cleopatra, there was torrent outpouring of outrage. People saying Cleopatra was black. How can you do this? Mm. She was Egyptian. But I mean, I think most scholars would say that's absolute tosh, wouldn't they, Tom? That
she's Cleopatra Macedonian.
She's undoubtedly Macedonian. Yeah.
Yeah. If she wasn't, it would have been mentioned.
Well, the key thing, I think, and a lot of scholars say this, is although it's not explicitly stated in the sources that her mother was Ptolemy's wife. So it's possible that she could have some other mother, Egyptian mother. The Romans would almost certainly have made use of it, wouldn't they? They'd have said,
well, so also would her siblings. Because the salient thing about the Ptolemies is that they're a horrific family. I mean, they are terrifying. And the female of the species tends to be deadlier than the male. So the girls are just as likely to stab in the back and kill, if not more so, than the boys.
Can I tell you my favorite Ptolemy family relationship? It's Ptolemy the Eighth, whose name was Physcon, which I think
Fatty.
Yeah, Fatty.
A beast.
So he married his sister, Cleopatra the Second, who had previously been married to their brother and had had a child by him. But then he tired of his own sister, so he married her daughter, who was also his niece. So now was at once his niece, his daughter-in-law, and his second wife all at once. His wife was cross and said, how dare you marry my daughter? You know, you're married to me, my brother. And so he was infuriated by his wife nagging him. So do you know what he did? He killed their 14-year-old son, chopped him up, and gave him to his wife as a birthday present.
Yeah, well, people periodically have tried to make films about or TV series about the Ptolemies, and it's so confusing that it never quite works. But that kind of mafia ambience is absolutely key to that these are murderous, terrifying people. But they're also seen by the light of the Romans, contemptible. So the other famous story that's told about that Ptolemy is that Scipio Aemilianus, who is the great war hero who has captured Carthage and is the absolute epitome of Roman militarism, turns up in Alexandria and he walks at a brisk pace through the streets. And poor old Ptolemy is enormously fat and dressed in silk. And he kind of every wobble and undulation as he totters and pants after Scipio is on display to the people of Alexandria. And it's a kind of deliberate attempt by the Romans to kind of humiliate them. I think that we should take a break at this point.
Okay.
And that when we come back, we should look more closely at the geopolitics of the world that Cleopatra is born into and the kind of the context that explains why her career is such a kind of triumph against the odds.
Jolly good. We'll see you in a minute.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Tom, it has been a little while, sadly, since we talked about our much-loved and learned sponsors at Unheard, the online magazine.
Would that be UNHERD?
That's precisely the spelling. Now, as you all know, Tom, or I hope you haven't forgotten, it's an online magazine that kicks back against herd mentality. Now, we're in the middle of talking about Cleopatra. Unheard's Kat Rosenfield has been looking into the cult, the fading cult, perhaps, of the girl boss, something I know you care a lot about, Tom, and it's perhaps best exemplified by Elizabeth Holmes, founder of the fraudulent multi-billion dollar health startup Theranos. This is a subject I know a lot about.
Theranos sounds very sinister.
Is sinister. Well, Theranos is basically a Bond villains organization, isn't it? Theranos.
You'd immediately think that's evil.
I do think it's evil. Well, I mean, I'm just, I don't want to be sued by Theranos. I'm sure they're lovely.
But they do sound evil.
Well, should I tell you what Kat writes?
Yes.
Would you enjoy that?
Yeah.
Kat writes, "The myth of Theranos might have shattered, but the legend of its founder lingers on. And as long as society remains enthralled to the narrative of the disruptor, the glass ceiling breaker, the patriarchy smasher, she won't be the only one. If Elizabeth Holmes hadn't existed, we would have had to invent her. And in some ways, we did." Yeah. Do you have thoughts on that, Tom?
Well, in light of, you know, what we're saying about Cleopatra,
yeah,
that's not without a certain relevance, is it?
It's incredibly relevant.
Yeah. And the sense in which Cleopatra was a genuine, you know, she genuinely broke through all kinds of glass ceilings.
She did.
But is also the invention of those who were terrified of her. The important thing is to say that if you want to kick back against herd mentality.
Which I do. I very much do.
You can join Unheard today and get 3 months free, Dominic. 3 months.
That's free. Not even a bargain. It's a freebie.
It absolutely is. They're giving it away. So just go to unheard.com, that's UNHERD/rest, REST, to claim this offer now. Right, back to Cleopatra.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. Tom, you were very excitedly going to talk about geopolitical context for the world in which so Cleopatra, we've been talking for more than 20 minutes and she's only just been born.
Well, because I think the context is really fascinating, which is that essentially, so we've talked about, say, British imperial power, and we've talked about countries like Argentina being, you know, or Egypt, say, actually,
yeah,
being part of an unofficial empire in which Britain's military, financial, naval power was such that they didn't have to come, you know, they didn't have to be administered by a British plenipotentiary, but they essentially couldn't do anything that the British didn't want them to do. And that's a very analogous situation to Egypt's relationship to Rome in the first century. The problem that the Hellenistic, the Greek world around the Near East had faced throughout the first century is that the Romans were unwilling to tolerate anyone who might kind of conceivably rival them. So every time some king stood up and tried to, you know, impose a degree of order or to display a degree of autonomy, the legions would come, topple him, hamstring his elephants,
yeah,
drag his treasure off to be spent in Rome, all that kind of stuff. But the Romans didn't want the hassle of actually administering this stuff. They didn't want to send in, you know, it would cost too much in terms of money and men to bother with all that.
Yeah.
So essentially, the Near East becomes a breeding ground for anarchy, which is part of why these Hellenistic kingdoms end up just collapsing. And Egypt really is, as the last kingdom left standing, it's in a really, really difficult position because it is massively under Rome's military and financial thumb, but it doesn't even have the benefit of knowing where it stands with Rome because it's constantly subject to the ambitions of all these kind of various rival warlords and bankers.
Well, this is the thing. So Auletes, who we talked about, Cleopatra's father, I mean, he's best known in Rome because basically his way of dealing with all this is to try and play off all the different Roman power brokers by bribing them, isn't it? So you got Pompey the Great, who models himself on Alexander the Great. So he's all these people. It's so interesting, isn't it? We were talking about this as a kind of sequel to our Alexander podcast, and it makes sense to see it that way because all the characters think they're in a sequel to the Alexander podcast.
Yeah,
don't they?
They are.
I mean, Pompey does his hair like Alexander. He claims he's got Alexander's cloak, and all
he's
of
always standing in profile.
Yes, exactly.
Kind of show off his quiff.
And as we'll see, you know, one of Mark Antony's, one of the part of his great downfall is he launches this invasion, which is an attempt to kind of reproduce the glory of Alexander in attacking the Persians. So Auletes he sends Pompey a golden crown. He sends Julius Caesar 6,000 silver talents. So he's basically throwing money around.
And the problem is that that money, I mean, most of it is raised from, you know, the long-suffering Egyptian peasantry who just, you know, just get... Egypt is the breadbasket of the Mediterranean, so therefore there's enormous amounts of money there, but they just keep screwing more and more money out of the long-suffering peasantry. But also he borrows a substantial chunk. So this banker called Rabirius, and this is exact a problem for Ptolemy in exactly the way that, say, you know, a third world country that gets into debt to the IMF or something.
Yeah,
it's a huge problem because it's then also becomes a problem for the Romans because they need their money back.
Well, they need their money, but also it infuriates the Alexandrian crowd because they're very proud, aren't they? They hate the Romans. They're inflamed by the fact that their, you know, their own country has got, as they see it, crippling taxes to bribe Roman power brokers. And they, you know, Auletius has got this impossible balancing act. He can't alienate the Romans because otherwise they'll invade, kick him out and replace him with somebody else. But equally, he can't suck up to them too much because his own people will rise up against him. And that's what happens in, I think, 58 BC when Cleopatra is probably about 10.
And Ptolemy has literally gone to Italy.
Yeah, there are huge riots, aren't there? And he basically ends up toppled. He ends up, doesn't he go to, has this terrible meeting with Marcus Cato, Tom? When Cato is on the toilet.
So Cato's been set. Cato is the model of integrity and upright behavior. And as a traditional representative of the Roman Republic, is utterly contemptuous of kind of fat, effete Egyptian kings. And insists on conducting all his business with him on the toilet.
So Auletius has been kicked out by his own people, and they replace him with Cleopatra.
And by his own daughter.
Yeah, by Cleopatra's older sister, Berenike. So they all have the same. What's slightly annoying is that all the people in the Ptolemaic dynasty, they only have one of about five names, don't they? Ptolemy, Arsinoe, Berenike, Cleopatra. There must be some other male name, but I don't know. They're just all called Ptolemy. So she takes over, and she rules for what, 3 years?
While her father is in Italy trying to raise the money and the men. So he's got all this cash that he's kind of extorted from the peasantry, borrowed from Rabirius, the banker, and he's raising the money to come back and take Egypt back. Berenike, meanwhile, has married a guy called Seleucus.
He's a brilliant man. Do you know what, if you got his nickname to hand?
Saltfish hawker.
Yeah, the saltfish monger, in the translation I have, because he stank of fish. The Alexandrians are all, not only are they very sort of decadent and stuff, but they're very snobbish, aren't they? They're basically
satirical.
They have distinctly unprogressive attitude towards foreigners.
And physical deformity.
But he's murdered. Berenike takes great
effect. Berenike gets fed up with him.
Yeah.
Gets rid of him, takes another husband. Yeah.
Yeah.
Rabirius, meanwhile, the banker whom Ptolemy's borrowed the money from, he essentially, you know, he knows that he's not going to get his money back unless Ptolemy's expedition works. So he funds an expedition that is led by a guy called Aulus Gabinius, and they go to Egypt. They kick Berenike out.
She's executed, isn't she?
She's executed. Ptolemy takes over again, and of course, the guy who leads the cavalry on that expedition is a young, up-and-coming Roman officer called Mark Antony.
Yes.
Do we have a section?
From a
brilliant new book?
Do you want a nice reading?
Yeah.
Gazing out from her window beside her servant girls, Cleopatra could not take her eyes off them. One Roman in particular caught her attention, a square-jawed, shaggy-haired, rugged-looking man who carried himself with the arrogance of a born leader. One of her servants whispered that this was the young cavalry commander all the girls were talking about. Some called him the new Heracles, but his real name was Mark Antony. Now, as the handsome young commander swung down from his horse and removed his helmet, he glanced casually up at the window. For a moment, his dark eyes met Cleopatra's, and he grinned. And suddenly, Tom Holland, it was as though time had slowed to a halt, and Cleopatra felt a kind of tremor run through her body, a thrill of fear and danger and overwhelming excitement all mixed up together. Isn't that exciting? Is that not exciting?
Wow. That really is.
That is a book for all 9-year-olds to read.
is yes, well, very, very exciting. Yes, so the likelihood is that Cleopatra may have seen Antony.
Well, she must have seen him. I mean, he's so senior because he's the cavalry commander who has led the charge.
Yeah.
And as her father is installed back in the palace. Yeah. So the palace, by the way, we should talk about just one quick word about that. So when we think about the palace, you're probably thinking Buckingham Palace or some sort of stereotypical palace, but it's not. It's a huge quarter of the city, isn't it? Mm. So there are temples that will become important later on when Julius Caesar enters the story, because the battle for the palace becomes very important. So Mark Antony has come in with Aulus Gabinius's men, who are called the Gabinians, and they become quite a, they become players in their own right in this incredibly complicated story. And Cleopatra's father is back in charge, and clearly she is very much in favor with him because she is not punished as her sister was. So the assumption must be, not least because she's now going to be his heir, that she in some way has still been loyal to him. And in fact, she, when she takes her pharaonic title, she always describes herself as the father-loving goddess or the father-loving queen.
Yeah.
So she's kind of on his side.
So Ptolemy Eleates is back, but he now faces the problem of paying off Rabirius, the banker who's lent him all this money. So he comes up with a cunning wheeze, which is to appoint Rabirius the finance minister.
Yeah.
And Rabirius obviously settles in and starts screwing ever more money out.
So to use your analogy, you know, Tom, it's like, you know, the British, the head of, you know, the Bank of England or something had gone to run the Argentine economy.
Yeah.
Or in 1890. Like,
The episode we did on Maximilian, Emperor Maximilian.
Yes.
Being sent by Napoleon III to get the money that the French had lent. Yeah, I think kind of very analogous. And as in those situations, obviously the locals don't like this. And so after a year, Rabirius gets kicked out, runs back to Rome, and Gabinius, who he's played this key role in Egypt. And so obviously everyone back in Rome is now furious with him, incredibly jealous. And what happens in Rome when people are jealous of one another is that they bring law cases. And Gabinius gets convicted of taking bribes from Auletes. He's obviously massively guilty of that. Mm. And so the whole thing slightly gets parked. Ptolemy is back in Egypt. He dies in 51. And meanwhile, in Rome, everything is starting to go tits up because this is 51 is 2 years before Julius Caesar crosses the Rubicon. And the whole Roman Republic is going to implode into civil war. And on rival sides in the civil war, we have Julius Caesar and his erstwhile friend, in fact, his erstwhile son-in-law, Pompey the Great.
And while that matters for Cleopatra is that she's Auletes' heir, isn't she?
Yes.
And with a civil war...
Together with her younger brother.
A civil war in the Roman world. Egypt is so rich and strategically important that it can't really, it's very, very difficult to stay out. You have to pick a side. But by picking a side, it's a bit like being the Liberal Democrats. By picking a side, you kind of, you pin yourself to a position. And if things go badly, you know, you've got no defense.
Yeah.
You know, that's the end of you, basically.
Yeah. So it's tricky and treacherous. And Ptolemy has left Egypt to Cleopatra, who's about 17, I think, at this point.
Yeah.
And Cleopatra's younger brother, who comes to the throne and is hailed as Ptolemy the 13th, and he's about, what, 12, 13?
Yeah, and they're probably not even that, Tom. I think it's about 11 or so. I mean, these dates are all very vague. It's impossible to be sure.
Something to say at this point is that Cleopatra never rules without a male colleague. So right the way through, she always has a male counterpart.
Egypt had had female pharaohs before, hadn't it? Hatshepsut. I know you're much more... on ancient Egypt.
Yeah.
So she's 18th dynasty. So there are role models. And obviously,
I don't think they would have looked back that far.
What about the popularity, Tom, of Isis? Because obviously, Isis is a colossal figure in the Egyptian pantheon and one that Cleopatra embraces. She dresses as Isis.
Well,
you know, is that not an image of kind of female monarchy?
So Cleopatra comes to power. She's 17. She has this young boy who is under the thumb of all kinds of significant players in her father's court. And they are clearly assuming that both of these young pharaohs will be ciphers.
Mm.
And insofar as one of them will succeed to power, it'll be Ptolemy. But Cleopatra has other ideas, and this is why she's such a remarkable figure, because even though even she can't get away with just ruling on her own as a woman, she is someone who is absolutely determined to rule as a pharaoh. So she puts her name first. You know, her name is ahead of Ptolemy's. She puts her name on coins. She puts her portrait on coins without Ptolemy. And she realizes that there is scope for her in playing not just the role of a Ptolemaic ruler, but a properly Egyptian pharaoh, because there is all this enormous kind of, you know, thousands and thousands of years of tradition and myth and heritage that she can draw on. And that as a woman, as you say, the great goddess Isis, an object of veneration across Egypt and far beyond Egypt, that if she can invoke that sense of herself as the mother goddess of Egypt, then that will get her popular support across the country, as well as Alexandria. And essentially, even though she's a very, very young girl, the leader of a country that is absolutely on its uppers, in debt to Rome, in the shadow of this great military superpower, she dares to think that she can essentially revive the fortunes of her kingdom and rule as Alexander had. And it's the most astonishing story. And that's what makes her such a remarkable figure. She profits from the much broader story that is going on of the Roman Civil War and what will become the implosion of the Republic. And I think that we should take a break at this point. And when we come back, we should look at what happens when Julius Caesar meets with Pompey, and then how Cleopatra comes to meet with Julius Caesar.
So for most of you, we will see you for the next installment of this thrilling historical saga, which will undoubtedly feature more readings from moving and powerful new histories of Cleopatra. So we will see you tomorrow, for most of you. But some of you, of course, will have early access to all the episodes because you're members of the Rest is History Club. And in true Hellenistic style, we never miss a commercial opportunity. So if you want to join the Rest is History Club and listen to all the episodes right now, just go to restishistorypod.com and sign up. And if you don't, we will see you tomorrow. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.